For years, I've been bragging on the team at Allied Outdoor Solutions in Houston for the beautiful work they do to make your outdoor area, your backyard, look like a resort. Well, their business has just grown and grown organically because they do great work. Your walkways, the area around your pool, your outdoor kitchen, all of that. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. And now, over the years, it's taken 20 years, they're now in Austin, Dallas, and San Antonio. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. 844-846-1010. Call them at 844-846-1010. Alan Dershowitz is our guest. Professor, it's an honor.
Well, it's my honor and my pleasure to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
There's no one whose opinion I'd rather hear that was not either a prosecutor or a member of the defense team on the Chauvin trial related to George Floyd than yours. I know you've been following that. Your thoughts?
My thoughts were that there's too much outside influence on the jury in this case. The jurors undoubtedly know that Congresswoman Waters has made essential threats to stay on the street, to be confrontational, unless there's a conviction for murder. Others have made similar statements. And outside influences should never, ever be allowed inside a jury room. The judge should have sequestered the jury earlier. The case should have been moved out of Minneapolis. And so I'm worried about whether there can be a fair trial. There should be a fair trial. He should be convicted based on the evidence. I think that there is enough evidence to sustain a manslaughter verdict, probably not enough for a murder verdict. But I'm worried that the conviction may be in danger. The judge said that. The judge said that the conviction might have to be thrown out, reversed on appeal, because of what Congresswoman Waters said. It was a terrible, terrible mistake for her to intrude herself into an ongoing jury trial like that.
To what extent is defense counsel, do they understand the politics behind a jury not wanting to convict because their city will get burned down, and they're simply trying this case to preserve it for an appeal, which when cooler heads prevail years down the road will exonerate him?
Well, that's a possibility. You never, ever count on an appeal. People don't realize that in most jurisdictions, fewer than 5% of appeals in criminal cases are granted. 95% of cases are affirmed on appeal. Obviously, I've been doing appeals for a long time, and I have a much better record than that. But for the most part, you can't count on winning an appeal, particularly in a situation like this, where if the appellate court were to reverse, even though it would be 6 months from now and the passions would have cooled, there'd still be repercussions. So I think they're all trying to get the verdict they want. And I think both sides, the prosecution and the defense, did good jobs as lawyers. I want to commend both sides for doing good jobs. The judge, I have some criticism of his instructions and his failure to move the trial out of Minneapolis and his failure to sequester the jury. But in general, he's also done a pretty good job. He certainly has created a good appearance for the judiciary, and his attack on Congresswoman Waters was entirely appropriate yesterday.
The defense seems to be relying heavily on the drug overdose defense, that mm-hmm. an alternate means of death. Is that what you would pound the hardest in your closing argument?
No, I don't think that's going to work, because the judge instructed the jury that all you need for causation is that it be a significant cause. And we all know that but for the knee on the neck or the knee on the shoulder, today George Floyd would be alive. He wouldn't have died spontaneously of his drug overdose or a heart attack or high blood pressure. So clearly, the knee on the neck, the knee on the shoulder, the prone position, the chest on the ground contributed significantly to his death. So I think you're going to lose that issue. If I were a defense attorney, I think I would have put Chauvin on the witness stand and tried to get him to testify about his intent, his state of mind, his feelings at the time, his fears. But they probably had good reasons for not putting him on the witness stand. There may be things that would come out that would otherwise not come out. So I don't want to second guess a defense attorney who knows more information than I do. But I think it hurt their case considerably that he did not testify. He's the best witness to his own state of mind.
My understanding is that he has a lot of IED violations that wouldn't look good, and that that's how they would be introduced. But not, as you said,
I think that's probably right.
Not to second guess the defense. But isn't it the case that many times in a case like this, you don't put your client on the stand if you don't think they make a good witness?
That's right. From everything I've seen about Chauvin, he looked like he'd make a very good witness on direct. The question is, would he be able to stand up to very, very effective cross-examination? The major lawyers on the prosecution side were very effective and very good cross-examiners. So I think they probably made a decision that they're better off going to the jury room without his cross-examination being the last thing on the mind of the jurors. And it would be very hard for him to justify, particularly the last 3 minutes, when it was clear that George Floyd was unconscious, that he was not resisting, that he couldn't resist, and at that point probably was either dead or close to being dead. It would be very hard to justify those last 3 minutes. You know, the prosecution said we have to look at 16 minutes. The defense said we have to look at 9 minutes. In my mind, you look at 3 minutes. It's the last 3 minutes that damn him, that make it clear that he should have done something different from what he did, certainly at the very end of the confrontation.
Professor, is there anything about this case, if you were the defense attorney, that you felt was that surprised you, that cut in your favor?
No, I think it was a predictable case. I think the one thing that surprised me was the testimony of Tobin, the prosecution's main expert, who just was too sure. He was just too certain of everything. For him, there were no ambiguities, and I think he would have been an easy witness to effectively cross-examine. I don't think the cross-examination of Tobin was as effective as it might have been. That's my only criticism. And there I do have a basis for criticizing, because I saw the cross-examination. I know what the science is, and I think they could have done a better job in exposing his extreme certainty. He came off as a very good witness because he was so sure of himself, but the science doesn't support what he said. For example, he said that the heart condition didn't contribute in any way to the death. Well, when you have an enlarged heart, you need more oxygen going to the heart, and therefore the denial of oxygen clearly would have had a different effect had he been a healthy young man with a small, working heart. So, I think
Professor, can you hold with me for just a moment?
Sure.
All right. One
sure.
Minute. Professor Alan Dershowitz is our guest. Professor, I want to switch gears if I could. Officer Sicknick, who died at the Capitol on January 6th, we now know much later, it seems much longer than was necessary to wait to hear, suffered two strokes and died of natural causes. He was not bashed over the head with a fire extinguisher. You've been rather public in defending President Trump and saying that his speech was constitutionally protected speech, and that it would be an honor and a privilege to defend him in a trial. Were the president's words, was the president wronged in the court of public opinion, and to have been argued that it was, that legally what he had done was somehow incite insurrection? Was he wronged in that?
Look, I think he was wrong in making the speech he did. I don't think he should have called on people to go to the Capitol and protest, even peacefully and patriotically, in front of the Capitol when Congress was actually considering the vote. I thought the dangers, the risk of some violence was too great. But he had a First Amendment right to do it, and what he did was perfectly lawful. If he had asked me my advice, I would have said, don't do it. So you can have a different view on the merits of what he did, which I disagree with, and on the legality of what he did, which I completely agree with. So I did defend his right to make the speech while at the same time criticizing the speech itself.
Are y'all still friends?
I've never been a friend. I mean, I've only met him half a dozen times in my life. I didn't know. I didn't vote for him. I voted for Biden. I voted for Clinton, not the liberal Democrat. So I never was a Trump, quote, supporter. I supported his policies on the Middle East. I supported some of his other policies, and I opposed others. I opposed his immigration policy. So I can't be called a supporter. As I say, I'm a liberal Democrat who believes that the Constitution comes before partisan arguments.
You have had some amazingly varied and fascinating celebrity defense clients and folks for whom you've worked on their team. Leona Helmsley, Julian Assange, Mike Tyson, Patty Hearst, Jim Baker, Klaus von Bülow.
Yeah.
Who sticks out to you as the one that was the most interesting personality to you personally?
You know, most celebrities aren't that interesting, particularly when they're in trouble. They're really in pretty desperate shape. The person I think was the most interesting is somebody you didn't mention. People hardly outside of Israel don't know him. His name was Anatoly Sharansky, Natan Sharansky, who was a dissident, a refusenik in the Soviet Union. And he was convicted of spying for the United States. And I helped with a number of other lawyers to get him free and released. And that took 8 years to do. And it took efforts by Congress and economic efforts and political efforts and legal efforts. So that was, he was probably the most interesting guy I've represented. But a lot of the people have been interesting. Mike Tyson was a fascinating guy, really interesting, really, really smart. And in my view, falsely convicted.
I'm forever grateful that when Ted Cruz was running for president, I guess they asked you his opinion, having been a professor at Harvard while he was there. And you said, look, I may not like his politics, but off the charts brilliant. I've known him for 25 years and I couldn't agree more. I thought that was very big of you.
Well, I appreciate that. I always say, tell the truth about my students. I'm never going to let their political views influence the quality of their mind. And Ted Cruz is a brilliant mind. He was a great student. I enjoyed very much having him in my classroom.
You're a fascinating guest.
We've remained in touch. Thank you.
You're a fascinating guest. I hope you'll come back and see us. Alan Dershowitz,
of course,
thank you.
Anytime. Thank you.
Right.
Bye.
And we recorded during the break more about the Chauvin trial in Minnesota. Here's what you missed. Professor, when you look at this trial and you put yourself in the shoes of an appellate judge, is there anything that jumps out at you? Is there anything the prosecution should have done better?
Oh, yeah. They should never have charged him with second-degree murder. Second-degree murder doesn't apply in a case like this. There's what's called a felony murder rule. If you go into a bank to rob a bank and somebody dies in the process, you're guilty of felony murder. If you start raping somebody and she dies of asphyxiation, that's felony murder. But here, the assault was part of the death. There's no separation between the felony and the death itself. And so I don't think the felony murder rule should apply in a case like this. And I think that is a basis for an appellate reversal. I also think third-degree murder, the statute says it has to pose a danger to others. By others, it means people other than the victim himself, like in the case where they shot into a dark room and not only was a woman killed, but the people next door. Their life was in danger. And so I think they overcharged the case. They should have charged it as a manslaughter case. And they'll probably win, but I think on appeal we may see some reversal of some of the counts.
You have been very successful in front of juries when the court of public opinion thought your client had no chance.
Right.
What have you learned about human nature and jurors to the extent that you can paint with a broad brush that prosecutors and defense attorneys tend to forget? How do they look at things differently than we, the public, through the media's eyes do?
I think the key to being a jury lawyer is not to tell the jury what to decide, but to lead them up to the point where they have the aha moment. And they say, aha, no, this couldn't have been. This doesn't make sense. You have to let the jury make the ultimate decision instead of trying to feed them. Juries resist when you tell them what to do. But when they come to their own conclusion that's favorable to your side, it's much more likely that that conclusion will remain in their minds.
How likely is a jury in a case like this to be, not in a legal sense, tainted, to be biased because of what they've seen? I mean, if you're preparing a case for this jury, how concerned are you as to the conclusions? I mean, you've tried some cases where you flipped their opinion. How tough is this going to be to do that?
It's going to be very tough in this case because of the outside pressures. Every one of these jurors is going to be saying to themselves, unconsciously, it won't come out in the jury room. They'll be saying to themselves, silently, unconsciously, if I vote to acquit, what impact is this going to have on my life, on my family, on my business, on my neighborhood? Are there going to be riots and demonstrations? That should never, ever be a factor in the minds of any jurors. Look, if you go back to the 1920s and 1930s, we know that the Ku Klux Klan would do that all the time in the South. They would stand in front of courthouses and threaten if the jury dared to acquit a black man or convict a white man, there were going to be demonstrations. And we shouldn't have that in our justice system. And I'm afraid that Congresswoman Waters and statements by other people and the media have communicated to the jury that one verdict would be more acceptable than the other. And that's just not the way that criminal justice should operate under the rule of law.
That was the conclusion of that interview with Alan Dershowitz.
My big health focus has been drink more water, get basic exercise, reduce your stress, and perhaps most important, better sleep and more sleep. You don't want to lay in bed where you can't sleep. I use thetrustedlab.com. Thetrustedlab.com comes directly to your home. I don't want to be involved with addictive drugs and medicine and all that. Completely healthy, completely natural, and I get results. Thetrustedlab.com.